John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. He's in Tashkent, but Gregory is my guide on the Horn of Africa and now to the on-again, off-again ceasefire in Sudan, the evacuations, the crisis, the darkness visible that closes on a country that is now between two well-armed forces led by men, both of whom claim to be the leadership. However, this speaks to the whole region, not only to the Horn of Africa, but also to the Sahel, the borderland of the Sahara, and neighboring Chad. I have a headline at Foreign Policy. Sudan's war might not stay in Sudan. A power struggle in the capital, reads the subhead, could destabilize neighboring Chad, impact the entire Sahel region. Gregory, I know that you have observed destabilization is a threat in the Horn of Africa as well. So we'll begin there. So far, the battle seems to be between two large personalities. The question is, this whole region is prey to enormous shipments of arms and individuals said to be military individuals who believe I could be the next and then fill in the blank in the capital. Is there something larger going on in the Horn of Africa, in the Nile River Valley, in the Sahel right now? Is this part of the transformation of the old empires into what comes next?
Well, it's certainly part of the transformation of African borders and African polities. We saw a brief period where the African Union, emulating the Organization for African Unity, which preceded it, attempting to contain the African states within the colonial borders. We saw them attempting to ostracize leaders who gained power through coups. But that period is over. A few years ago, with the absence of any European or North American influence in Africa and the, if you like, benign influence of the People's Republic of China, we saw the return of the era of the coups in Africa. And we saw in Mali, we saw in other places, we've seen it literally coming in different forms throughout Africa. And it's no surprise that the military in Sudan wanted to resume power in their own right without sharing it with the civilians. And that's what we're seeing. And as you say, it's now a fight between two major military figures as to who is going to be the military ruler. The reality is that when President Omar al-Bashir was removed, and that was largely, if you like, with the support of some of the other military officers who were happy to see him go, we all thought that this was a move toward the democratization or the civilianization of government in Sudan, but it was really wishful thinking. Now, we've got governments in the region, neighboring governments, not just Chad, which is critical because Chad has been the receiving and point for a lot of Islamist and jihadist movements coming down through Sudan and Chad and into Niger and Nigeria. It's been the conduit for a lot of bad things that have been pushed through Sudan in the past. So Chad is going to feel the brunt of any spillover of refugees and the like coming out of the area, but so will Egypt, because Egypt is tightly linked, as it has been for millennia, with Sudan, and Egypt is in a poor economic condition right now. So any spillover of Sudanese refugees into Egypt will also have a destabilizing effect. It's not going to help South Sudan, which is itself embroiled in a a fairly static type of civil war of its own. So the question is, what can the West do about it? And the answer is very little at this stage, because nobody wants to put the kind of resources necessary into stabilizing Sudan. I know we've seen a lot of headlines about the brilliant evacuation of U.S. embassy staff from Sudan, that was, I think, the great thing that concerned the State Department and the Biden White House, is that they would they could suffer another reputation loss if they had a withdrawal of U.S. personnel of the same disastrous capability that we saw in Kabul a year or two earlier. But in fact, it was pulled off flawlessly and very well executed. But the British did the same thing with their staff. The People's Republic of China did the same thing with their staff. All of the major powers and everybody and their dog withdrew their embassy staff. The question is, what now? Is Sudan just to be left to its fate, or will there be some room for negotiation? It's unlikely that the Jamjaweed militia are going to go away peacefully, because there is nowhere for them to go. If they surrender, it's unlikely that they will be left in peace by the military government.
Gregory, I go immediately to Ethiopia, which has been a great concern of ours for more than a year because of the civil war there. There is turmoil, significant, after the death of the leader of the Prosperity Party. There have been arrests made, announced in these last days. None of this is transparent, and all these reports can be corrected. But clearly the Amhara Liberation Front is said to be in some way connected to this. The arrests in some fashion are connected to the turmoil. I don't know whether these claims are made conveniently or whether they're accurately. You can't tell. But Sudan borders Ethiopia, as you've taught me, and at one point was tasked by outside actors, perhaps in Cairo, to destabilize Ethiopia. And that did not happen yet. Do I say that correctly, that Ethiopia remains extremely vulnerable to the disorder in Sudan and to bad actors from outside?
There's no question about that. And the government, the Prosperity Party government under Prime Minister Abe, has been complicit in attempts to disarm the Amhara people, who had been preparing their own militias to prevent further genocidal attacks on the Amhara people by the Oromo Liberation Front and the old Tigray Popular Liberation Front. Prime Minister Abiy was seen as, you know, basically supporting some of these movements to constrain the Amhara people. And certainly the Amhara are going to be blamed for anything now. And this will be used as a major excuse to clamp down on the Amhara militia in particular, and to attempt to disarm them. I think that will be resisted. And that could be the start of something very, very serious. And what's interesting is that the Eritrean government, which had supported Prime Minister Abiy, would now support the Amhara people and the Amhara militia in resisting any further incursions into the Amhara and Afar territories.
So what we have here is the Amhara empowered in some fashion by an assassination. What about the Tigray Popular Liberation Front? Have they retired from the scene?
The TPLF has more or less retired from the scene for the time being. They're certainly not to be dismissed. And it's, by the way, it's not even inconceivable that the TPLF would trust the Amhara more than they would trust the Oromo in any resurgence. But I don't think the Amhara people feel empowered by the death of the Prosperity Party leader, but there has been a lot of discussion that the Amhara segment of the Prosperity Party would split off and or attempt to remove Prime Minister Abiy from his leadership. So we've seen in the last few months a great amount of fear, a lot of paranoia among the leadership, including Prime Minister Abiy, as to potential challenges to his power.
I want to connect this to the general question I've had for more than a year. Where is the U.S. State Department? I know in Ethiopia, there was reason to believe the State Department was picking a winner, and the winner turned out to be a loser. That would be the TPLF. The State Department certainly is cognizant of whatever goes on in Cairo, and I presume Khartoum as well. But what is the U.S. policy in general for the Horn of Africa? Does it recognize the destabilization threats by outside actors? Does it present itself as an answer to brutality?
I don't think there's a coherent U.S. policy on the Horn of Africa or the Red Sea at this particular time. There was, and there's been traditional approaches by the U.S. to securing the Red Sea, and much of that is centered around support for the Egyptian government. Once upon a time, it also centered around support for the Haile Selassie government of Ethiopia, which was then a major power on the Red Sea. But since then, since the departure of Haile Selassie in 1974, U.S. policy has been relatively incoherent, whether it's in Somalia, Somaliland, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Sudan, and the like. Today, the State Department still has some kind of favoritism for the TPLF. And that was okay when the TPLF was the governing power of all of Ethiopia. And it hasn't been that since about 2018. So it was time then for the State Department to review its position on Ethiopia and start looking toward the new post-communist government, which was started to take over in 2018. And it hasn't done that. It's continued to support the TPLF. And this has been a major cause for concern and a major reason for the distrust of the Ethiopian government in the United States. It caused, in fact, it's this, if you like, unbelievable continued support by the State Department for the TPLF and therefore the civil war caused Prime Minister Abiy to have to go to Moscow and Beijing for military support to fight the TPLF. So Prime Minister Abiy was a profound supporter of the West and the United States until the United States forced him to become an enemy. And I wouldn't say he would view himself as an enemy of the U.S. right now, but he had to go to Beijing and Moscow for arms and to Turkey to defeat the TPLF. And the U.S. was not in a mood to help him or to help save the unity of Ethiopia.
And therefore, what we have here is a new day. Is that how to regard this, that the turmoil in Sudan is part of the new day, that the Egyptian anxiety about water in the Nile Basin is part of a new day? We turn to page. Or is it the empires battling? Is it the Chinese empire, the Russian empire, the American empire, the European empire battling again about Africa?
Well, the foreign powers are attempting to gain influence, but actually doing very badly, the Chinese and Russians included. The Russians are limited in their reach into Africa, but it's still quite extensive. The Chinese are not well-liked in many parts, and the U.S. is just floundering. So it's really about the breakdown of law and order in many regions of North Africa, and parts of sub-Saharan Africa, particularly, for example, South Africa itself. So we're seeing the outside powers losing traction in Africa, unfortunately, and we're seeing the contagion of angst and unrest and various groups wanting to take the law into their own hands. We're seeing the return to the era of coup d'etats throughout Africa. And we're not seeing that the U.S. has much support from the neighbors of the region, namely the Middle East. The U.S. has lost traction with Israel. It's lost traction with Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and the like. So the question is, what do we do? Do we just watch parts of Africa burn, or do we find some other ways to assist? But I don't see any really new thinking taking place in Paris, London, or Washington.
Gregory Copley is editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. He's in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. We're going to turn to London, England next, the King Charles Report on the eve of the coronation. What is King Charles III worth if you write it down on a bottom line? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Experience the freedom of finding the one at Haverty's. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate this summer at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Boto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.